Pete Walsh on behalf of Platinum Equity. It is my pleasure to introduce to the court Kevin Reed, who is a partner with Quinn Emanuel, Urquhart, Oliver & Hedges in New York City. Mr. Reed will be making the argument on behalf of Appellee Platinum Equity. Also seated at counsel's table is Kevin Janis of the same firm. And also in the courtroom is Eva Kalowski, who is the Vice President and General Counsel of Platinum Equity. Thank you.
Welcome to Delaware.
Good morning. May it please the court, Dan Folk for the Roan plaintiffs below and appellants. I have the pleasure of introducing my partners today, John Sirocco, who will be providing our argument and who has been admitted pro hac vici, and John Delaportis. And I also have in the courtroom today Mr. Horace Ward, who's the former CEO of Roan and the current bankruptcy administrator.
Welcome to Delaware. You may proceed when you're ready.
Your Honors, if it pleases the court, I've indicated that I'll reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal at the end of my principal argument. Thank you. Your Honor, this is a case where the Superior Court's decision must be reversed for the principal reason that the Superior Court applied an incorrect legal standard to a correct finding that it had made. Basically, under the Superior Court's decision, Platinum Equity, who is the acquirer here, was allowed to terminate an acquisition of certain selected assets from Roan on the grounds of a provision in their acquisition agreement that allowed them to terminate the contract, terminate the acquisition, if they believed as a matter of law or fact that they would face material asbestos liability emanating from the transaction. They also had to reach that determination in good faith. So as a functional matter, the appellant here, Roan, had two layers of protection against Platinum Equity exercising that termination right. The first layer of protection was that there had to be an objective basis on which someone could reasonably say, based on the facts and based on the law, that they would face material asbestos liability if they acquired from Roan these selected non-asbestos assets. The lower court correctly held that no such finding on the law or the facts was possible. And the Superior Court's decision is very lengthy on this point. It's very comprehensive, and it goes through essentially a belt and suspenders analysis of all the protection that the acquirer here had that would have prevented any objective, reasonable conclusion that by acquiring these non-asbestos assets, they would have faced a material asbestos liability. It wasn't a merger. It wasn't an acquisition of Roan as a going concern. They were simply buying some cellular tower assets that had nothing to do with asbestos. And as the lower court indicated, there were at least five or six very strong layers of protection, including channeling injunctions, decisions by Judge Easterbrook on the Seventh Circuit that had been failed to be appealed to the United States Supreme Court, or rather cert had been denied. There had been a discharge in bankruptcy, and then there had been an entire history of no one ever making such a claim for over 13 years. So the lower court's opinion is very firm and very accurate on the point that no objective person could have foreseen material asbestos liability. In addition, that determination had to be made in good faith. That's where the Superior Court, I say with respect, got detoured. The Superior Court looked at the words in good faith, and instead of understanding those words to mean that Roan had another layer of protection against Platinum terminating this transaction, the Superior Court unfortunately saw in the words in good faith a freestanding license to Platinum to be wrong about the facts and the law, but yet be able to terminate the transaction without consequence. The reason that's wrong is what New York law says about transactions like this, and New York law is the governing law here. New York law makes it very plain that except when you're talking about contracts that imply an issue of taste or whim, a contract for me to buy a painting and to pay $5,000 for it, as long as I think it somehow captured my daughter's smile, that's something that can only be reviewed for good faith. But in a commercial transaction, which this was, the New York cases, the UCC is adopted in New York, the restatement of contracts, as it's been followed in New York, make it very plain that the overarching rule, the general rule, and the rule unfortunately not followed by the Superior Court, is that good faith doesn't mean whim. Good faith itself means the same issue of commercial reasonableness and a reasonable basis in law and fact. And consequently, what we wound up with in the Superior Court's decision was a determination, an opinion, that was at war with itself.
Well, help us understand where the advice of counsel fits into this. If I understand the record, there was an initial opinion that said you're going to have a problem, and the briefs tell us why that was superficial, cursory, however you want to characterize it. I mean, I'm trying to summarize what the briefs say. And then I understand the contract was extended for a week, and your client basically got to say everything you just told us to the lawyer who had given the cursory opinion. And having heard everything you had to say about the Seventh Circuit, 13 years of nobody challenging anything, the trust is really a viable entity, and the lawyer said, I'm not changing my mind. I think you still have a problem. Now, as I understand your opponent's argument, they were entitled to rely on the advice of counsel to demonstrate good faith.
Justice Holland, in response to that, several points. Number one, our position, and we think the law is very clear on it, and we have treatment of this specifically in our reply brief, we don't believe there is such a thing as an advice of counsel defense to a breach of contract. If I'm to buy some widgets from you and my lawyer says I don't think you need to take delivery and a court says no, under the contract you needed to take delivery, it does not avail me to say, but I asked my lawyer and he felt differently.
But does it make any difference at all if the language of the contract itself uses the term in good faith and the facts suggest, at least, depending on how one wishes to read them, that reliance on the advice of counsel is acting in good faith?
Here, note, Mr. Chief Justice, because in New York law, which is the governing law here, the words in good faith, and we expand on this in our papers, has a specific meaning. What it means is it must have a reasonable factual basis. Unless we're talking about someone making a dress, unless we're talking about someone painting a portrait, if we're talking about a commercial transaction like this, in good faith does not have a meaning different from the other language in the termination provision, which talked about reasonable basis in law and fact. It, in fact, means essentially the same thing.
So it's redundant?
No, it's not redundant. It was another layer of protection for Roan in the following sense. What it meant was that the termination could not be pretextual. Platinum couldn't terminate the agreement because it suddenly, at the 11th hour, found another seller of these towers who was offering perhaps a lower price. So it was a belt and suspenders protection for Roan against the transaction being terminated under commercially unreasonable terms. Protection in two places.
Well, but I think what we're trying to separate are concepts that seem to be blended in the briefs. As I understand it, your opponents went to a lawyer that they dealt with for quite a while. The lawyer went to Yale Law School. He's with Kirkland and Ellis and looks like the right person to go to get an answer. Now, the Superior Court said, you might have gone to the right person, but you got the wrong answer. And whether or not he got it right or wrong, let's assume he got it wrong, It's like people who go to any professional. You know, the dentist says you got to have your tooth pulled when somebody could have filled it. Why is it not good faith to rely on advice from what looks like an otherwise credible, reliable source?
Well, Justice Holland, just on that point, the Superior Court said more than simply that the lawyer got it wrong. The Superior Court also said not only did the lawyer get it wrong, but the lawyer got it wrong because the process the lawyer went through was slipshod and inadequate. And the Superior Court was very firm and very direct, in effect saying the analysis was wrong, the wrong questions were asked, the attention given the matter was insufficient, and all of it resulted in the wrong answer being given. But the point I keep coming back to, Mr. Justice, is the fact that that would have some relevance if perhaps there could be, as I said before, an advice of counsel defense to a breach of contract claim, but there can't, and even closer to home under Rule 11, when parties file papers in court and there's some question about whether that's a valid claim or someone is advancing too aggressive a theory, we know that it avails a party nothing to say, well, I gave this matter to my lawyer, and here is the complaint that was filed. In fact, what we know is if judges believe that the complaint that was filed was objectively unreasonable, the fact that you tell the court, well, a lawyer filed it for me, and I went to a lawyer, and he went to Yale Law School or any law school, means nothing. The lawyer is in trouble, and you're in trouble.
So your reading of New York law is a little bit like what we see in tax cases. You go to a CPA that tells the taxpayer you can take a deduction. You take the deduction based on your accountant's advice. If you get it wrong at the end of the day, the taxpayer is the one with the problem.
The old adage on that is it's your tax rule, meaning that the fact that you thought you could deduct giving away your old tennis racket doesn't mean you can. And while it might mean that you had a, if you went to H&R Block, maybe they have a penalty payback provision as part of their marketing, but the IRS certainly doesn't want to hear about it, and Roan certainly didn't want to hear about it. In addition, the process was terrible.
Well, that's
he
why
was on a ski slope, and he gave scant attention to this, and he basically, I think we've all been there, perhaps in our practice careers, you know, you're up on the ski lift and someone's saying, well, we want to do a transaction, but there may be asbestos liability. I think what we all know happens as a practical matter is lawyers err on the side of caution, but that can't all happen to the prejudice of Platinum. They had a provision in there which said, this is a done deal. This deal is going forward, except in one eventuality. If, as an objective matter, a legal matter, a factual matter, the acquirer Platinum can make a good faith showing that there's a realistic, reasonable chance of material asbestos liability. The Superior Court blew that proposition 50 feet out of the water. The Superior Court also blew 50 feet out of the water the process by which the lawyer went through to give such advice as he gave. Where the Superior Court got hung up was the Superior Court looked at the words good faith. And reading this one case, Dalton, the exception in Dalton, the Superior Court allowed to swallow the rule. The rule in New York, which is the governing law, is when you've got one of these clauses, what it absolutely means, proof positive, is that you're looking at an objective standard, which the Superior Court, again, found wasn't close to being met here, unless you're talking about that very fine, small exception for those contracts which, by their definition, are issues of taste or whim. Whether a woman feels a dress makes her look attractive enough, whether I feel a painter has done a good enough job capturing the glint in my child's eye. Those are things that are reviewable only for good faith. I can terminate that contract if I honestly believe that the painter didn't capture my son's smile. I can't terminate it simply because I found a cheaper painting. That's why it's not redundant. That's what it's there for.
Did the drafting history reflect why the term in good faith was present in this contract and not just
left with objective findings?
The drafting history of this, Mr. Chief Justice, is that this was language put into the agreement as drafted by Platinum, and therefore, if there is confusion or ambiguity as to how those instances of verbiage here were to interact, another argument we've made is that that needs to be construed against Platinum. But I don't think you even need to go there, because all you need to do is be guided by New York law, and New York law is very clear that this language in good faith is not, as unfortunately the Superior Court saw it, another freestanding trapdoor for Platinum to exit this transaction. It has a specific meaning, except in those contracts that talk about whim or taste. What it means is the same thing as was meant by the other language further down in the provision. If you look at the UCC, that's the only conclusion you can reach. If you look at the restatement, that's the only conclusion you can reach. And if you look at the New York cases like Alper Blouse and J.D. Cousins, that's the only conclusion you can reach. And in fact, J.D. Cousins' Second Circuit case contains a very good explanation of exactly what this map of contracts looks like, and it basically says maybe up here in a corner is an exception for contracts of whim and taste, but everything else, even if the words good faith are in there, the words good faith means an objective standard. The Superior Court found that on an objective standard, Platinum wasn't even close.
You'd like to save the balance of your time?
Thank you. Yes, I would. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Kevin Reed, here on behalf of appellees Platinum Equity and P. Frank. The convention has been to refer to them both as Platinum, and I'll continue that. The decision of the Superior Court should be affirmed. The Superior Court correctly determined, first, that Platinum's decision to terminate the agreement with Roan based on a concern about asbestos liability was by contract subject only to good faith review, and second, that Platinum had in fact acted in good faith. The Superior Court's decision can also be affirmed for the independent reason that Platinum's invocation of the so-called asbestos termination provision was objectively reasonable. I'll talk more about both of those issues in a few moments, but with the Court's indulgence, I would first like to focus briefly on an important aspect of the factual context in which this dispute arose. In particular, I'd ask the Court to take note that in November 2002, Roan was a company without options. It had just weeks to find a buyer for all of its assets, to negotiate a definitive agreement, and to bring the transaction to a close all before the end of the year, or it would forfeit a very large tax refund. After searching for months and contacting more than 90 companies, they had received an expression of interest from only one company, O'Brien Steel, and O'Brien attached a financing contingency to its offer. So in the words at trial of Roan's general counsel, that was not doable. That's at Appendix 342, A342. And it was at that point, in early November 2002, that Platinum came into the picture. On November 11th, Platinum submitted its first indication of interest, crucially from Roan's perspective. Platinum made clear that it did have the necessary financing. Platinum was also an experienced acquisitions company that committed to get the deal done in the short time frame that Roan required.
And does everyone agree this is a sale of assets for fair value?
Yes, sir.
Well, isn't it corporate law 101 that if a company sells its assets for fair value, that no liabilities go with it?
I don't know that that's true or not, but I do know that from Platinum's perspective, there was an issue of asbestos liability, and they wanted to get an expert to look at it.
Now, as I understand it, no one ever gave a written legal opinion. Is that correct? Everything was verbal?
There was one initial memo that Mr. Spiegel, our lawyer from Kirkland & Ellis, sent us, in which he flagged, sort of on a preliminary basis, there's an issue as to whether or not the channeling injunction.
But he was passing along the research of the associate,
which he had testified that he'd reviewed and believed in. And then the testimony further established that there were oral conversations throughout the rest of that month, including conversations with Roan's lawyers from Fried Frank on the phone, where Mr. Spiegel expanded on and adhered to his advice. And as a matter, as a factual finding, the court determined what the advice was.
Well, then that, well, let's go to the advice because I'm a little confused on the record. Maybe you can help me. But it seems that at one point the advice seemed to suggest, because there had never been a judicial determination about something in the past, someone could say it really didn't count. And then if the trust didn't have all the assets it needed for claims, these very aggressive plaintiff's lawyers would go for the deep pocket, and that even if Roan wasn't going to have any liability, substantive liability for asbestos exposure, it was going to have to pay perhaps $35 million in legal fees. So my question is, was the bottom line legal advice, you may have a problem with actual liability, or was the bottom line legal advice, it looks like you're not going to have any liability, but we don't know what these plaintiff's lawyers are going to do, and if you buy these assets, they may come after you and you'll incur legal fees, which seem to be two different issues.
I think the advice, first of all, is found as a matter of fact on page 13 of the opinion. My summary of it would be this. The lawyer said there's a reasonable argument to be made that the channeling injunction is not covered by Section 524 of the Bankruptcy Code.
Because the judge didn't sign off on it.
Because the requisite fair and equitable finding was not made at the time that plan was confirmed. That's sort of step one. Step two is, in the event somebody persuades a court that this injunction does not have that protection, if somebody goes to court and makes that argument and wins, you, in essence, could open the floodgates to a bunch of very aggressive plaintiff's lawyers who will sue any target that exists in the hopes of getting a recovery. I don't think Mr. Spiegel opined as to whether or not you would ultimately be held liable on those claims. I think the testimony at trial, as supported by an expert, was that in the event these floodgates are open, you are looking at massive, potentially massive defense costs.
So what does the contract mean? If you don't have any basis for liability, someone could always sue you anyway. And it seems that that's an important distinction to make. The first determination is, do you realistically have some liability? And the second is, even if you don't realistically have any liability, you may have to incur attorney's fees to prove it.
I think you have to fall back to the provision in the contract, which allows Platinum to terminate if it has a reasonable basis to conclude that it could be subject to any material liability for any asbestos-related claim. And I don't think that provision limits the liabilities that Platinum is allowed to consider to judgments.
So I think under your reading, then, if they said, look, we're just afraid, based on your history, that you're everyone's favorite target, and that if we buy your assets, we may get pulled into a lawsuit. So if they would have said unequivocally, our fear is getting pulled into a frivolous lawsuit, you think that would have been a good faith basis not to go forward?
No. I think if they had said simply, we have a non-particularized fear that we could get pulled into a frivolous lawsuit, that would not be good faith. But that's not what happened here. What happened here was that they said, we have been advised by a Yale-trained lawyer, an expert in bankruptcy that we've used on over 20 occasions, that if we go through with this, there's a risk we could be subject to millions and millions of dollars of defense costs defending asbestos claims. That, I submit, is good faith.
So that defense costs means material liability?
Yes.
You don't think liability, words like liability and exposure and other terms that are generally used in the industry are terms of art?
I don't think anybody's ever argued to date, and I don't think it's the fact that a provision that says any material liability relating to any asbestos claims as a term of art excludes defense costs. I don't believe that's true.
Did the Superior Court make any finding in that respect? Or is it implied in her conclusion that there was no material objective basis to conclude that there was going to be exposure to asbestos suits?
I think it's implied in her ruling, based on the advice that was given, that defense costs could result and provided a basis to terminate the agreement, that she believed that this asbestos termination provision allowed Platinum to consider the possibility of incurring multimillion-dollar defense costs.
So you disagree with the other side, who said pretty emphatically that there was no finding by the Superior Court to support a conclusion that there was a material objective basis to conclude there was exposure to liability or exposure to damages or exposure to cost from asbestos cases.
and that the Superior Court judge solely relied on a misinterpretation of the term in good faith. You disagree with that?
I'm not sure I got all of that, but let me try.
I'm not sure it was articulated very well, but let's pass on that and do your best to answer it.
I think it's clear from the opinion that the Superior Court felt that Platinum did not have an objectively reasonable fear that it would either be held liable on a judgment for an asbestos claim or that it would incur defense costs for an asbestos claim. That, I think, is fairly clear from the opinion. We think it's wrong, but it's in the opinion. I think it's also clear.
So you would at least agree with your opponents that that is the finding of the Superior Court?
Yes, I believe it's the finding of the Superior Court that that the concern identified by Platinum's attorney was not objectively reasonable.
Now, the way you stated that sounded to me like you included cost in saying the Superior Court made a finding in that regard. Now, but just a moment ago, you said it was implied in her ruling that costs were a factor. Were they or were they, are costs a material objective factor or not?
I apologize if I've been unclear. I think the court found that to the extent Platinum's lawyer advised it that going through with this transaction could cause it to incur material defense costs for asbestos liability, that that advice was objectively unreasonable and wrong. The court also found, however, that Platinum relied on that advice in good faith, and that under the contract, its reliance on that advice gave it a basis to terminate. Because the question here ultimately, and this really gets to the heart of the issue, the question isn't whether the lawyer was right or wrong. The question is, did Platinum, having gotten this advice from an objectively qualified lawyer to whom it had given all the benefit of the information that Roan had provided, did the contract authorize Platinum to terminate when that unquestionably qualified lawyer identified a basis for Platinum to believe there could be a risk of millions of dollars in liabilities?
That leads me to suggest to myself anyway, based on what I've just heard, that this case boils down to, does the law allow a party to rely on the advice of counsel or not?
I think what the case boils down to is, what is the meaning of this asbestos termination provision? Is it, as the court found, that Platinum has the right to make the decision as to whether or not there's an objectively reasonable basis?
So it's as simple as this language, in your view, is a walk-away provision?
It's a walk-away provision with a limit. In other words, Roan portrays it as if they signed a deal that gave Platinum the right to walk away for any reason or no reason at all. That's clearly not the case. Platinum, in the course of due diligence, in trying to complete this deal in 3 weeks, identified a specific risk.
But isn't your position, we acted in good faith because we relied on the advice of counsel?
Yes.
Now, so we go back to the Chief Justice's question. I understand that you rely primarily on the Dalton decision. Is that correct?
Certainly that was one of the authorities we relied on.
Well, this is the time to tell us all of them, if there are any more that you want us to look at primarily. But how do you respond to the argument that Dalton's distinguishable because this is a different type of contract?
I respond to it this way. There's nothing in Dalton, in the part of the opinion, where the court reaffirms that a party given discretion under a contract has the right to exercise that only subject to good faith review. There's nothing in that part of the opinion which limits it to the particular context of the case. I think
So your position is New York law provides for reliance on the advice of counsel to constitute good faith?
In the appropriate circumstance. Let me try and clarify. They argue in their brief that good faith, or rather advice of counsel, is not a defense to breach of contract. And that's unquestionably true. You can't breach a contract and then say, but my lawyer told me it was okay. But the question here isn't whether Platinum's breach was excused. The question here is whether Platinum breached at all. And when the question of whether or not you breached a contract turns on whether or not you believed something in good faith, then yes, the question of how good faith is to be decided and can turn on whether or not you got advice of counsel.
So even if the aspect of cost is not and could not be liability in the term of art sense that we generally look at the word liability, and therefore there's no material objective basis to terminate this contract, if their lawyer told them there was, if their lawyer said to them, costs are in fact a material issue and are the same thing as liability because of the exposure of expense of paying the cost of aggressive asbestos plaintiff's litigation, then they in good faith can rely on that.
They can, but that's not what the lawyer here told them. The lawyer here did not give them an opinion on the construction of this contract. The advice that we got from the lawyer here was that, yes, you have a reasonable basis to believe that if you go through with this deal, you might incur millions of dollars of defense costs defending asbestos claims. And the lawyer didn't tell them one way or another. That either gives you a right to terminate under this provision or it doesn't. What we've argued to the district court and what the court, as I said earlier, impliedly found is that when a contract says you can terminate if you have a reasonable basis to fear any liability relating to any asbestos claim, that means that if you get advice that gives you a good faith basis to believe that you could suffer defense costs
let's assume, like the Superior Court, that cost of defending litigation is not liability. And when the lawyer told them that, that was wrong. They still are able to rely on it?
I would take issue with your question in the sense that I don't think the court found that defense costs, in fact, the court did not find that defense costs are not a liability that Platinum was entitled to take note of under the contract.
Well, maybe it's just me, but I thought I heard the opposite just a few minutes ago.
What the court said was when the lawyer told Platinum that they would incur defense costs, that the lawyer was wrong. The court did not, however, say that Platinum's belief that it incurred defense costs was not a basis to terminate under this provision. It boils down to, I mean, you could change the hypothetical to whether or not the lawyer told them they were going to suffer a judgment of liability for asbestos. The court, I think, is equally saying if this lawyer had told you that you could be held liable for an asbestos claim, you would be wrong. That doesn't mean that you're not entitled to take that advice and view that as a basis to terminate under the provision.
So let's change it slightly. And if your client had gone to someone who only did real estate law and tried to get an opinion and got the wrong advice, perhaps someone could say you didn't act in good faith because you went to someone that didn't know anything about this subject matter and you got an answer that was wrong. But because your client went to someone that they dealt with in similar circumstances who was an expert in this area, the fact, we'll assume in my question, that they got the answer wrong is not relevant to whether or not your client acted in good faith, went to the best source they could, and if they got bad advice, they still acted in good faith.
Exactly. If they had gone to a fortune teller, or if they had gone to Platinum and said, we had a dream last night and felt we could suffer asbestos liability, that clearly wouldn't be good faith. But they did hear everything that a reasonable business person could be expected to do when dealing with a complex area beyond the ken of an ordinary layperson.
Why would that not be good faith if it's a subjective standard?
Because under the provisions of this contract, and this is why we take issue with their description of the provision as just an unfettered walk-away right. This contract says you can terminate if you determine in good faith that there exists a reasonable basis in law and in fact to fear material asbestos liability.
Well, so is there an objective component of good faith or not?
There is not an objective component of good faith in this contract.
Well, then what distinguishes the fortune teller from going to the Yale lawyer?
Well, this is where Dalton comes into play. Dalton defines good faith under New York law as you can't act arbitrarily or irrationally. If I came to you and I said, we had a reasonable basis in law to believe that we could suffer asbestos liability because our fortune teller told us to, you would look at me like I was crazy, and deservedly so. But that's not what I'm here saying. I'm saying we had a reasonable basis. We formed a good faith basis to believe that there was a material risk of asbestos liability here, based on the advice of a Kirkland & Ellis Yale-educated lawyer that we'd used 20 times before and who's an expert in this area.
So there is an objective component of good faith, then.
I guess I take issue with your use of the term objective because it's loaded given the context of the argument.
Well,
good faith has there are limits. Good faith can't be anything. But New York and Dalton tells you what the limits are.
Well, a term that your opponent used was pretextual. It couldn't be pretextual. It couldn't be sort of a sham basis.
It couldn't be pretextual.
It had to have some material basis in fact. Now, it seems that the Superior Court found there was none here, but your view is that the advice of counsel creates one, even if that advice is wrong.
The Supreme Court,
is that an unfair characterization of your position?
It is. The Superior Court found that, first of all, the Superior Court found that there was no issue of pretext, that we had an honestly held belief that there was a risk of asbestos liability. The Superior Court also found that our belief was founded on bad legal advice. But the court found that under the contract, the test was, did we undergo a reasonable process and act in good faith by pursuing, you know, the answer in a diligent and responsible fashion?
Well, and then that's where your opponent introduces the ski slope. And what he said is you shouldn't rely on advice that's not in writing when someone's on vacation on a ski slope. Does that make a difference? Or does the fact that this person has this history of knowledge and expertise mean that he can render advice, you know, no matter where he is?
I think, frankly, that's a cheap shot on the part of the other side and a distortion of the record. Bennett Spiegel did not dispense advice from a ski lift. He wrote a memo that he had an associate write a memo that he reviewed. He then spent hours on the phone in subsequent conversations over the next ensuing weeks, including hours spent with their lawyers, in which this point was debated. So to suggest that this was sort of an off-the-cuff, back-of-the-envelope analysis is wrong.
So that goes back to my earlier questions, and that was that no matter how cursory the advice might have been initially, once the contract was extended for a week, it's your position, the record shows, the other side got to make every argument they wanted to, and notwithstanding complete information, the legal advice to your client was still the same.
I think that's true, but I would amplify it by clarifying that there was not, it suggests that he got, that there was a memo written, and then there was really nothing else done until these phone calls weeks later. And the record doesn't support that. What actually happened is there was an initial memo, then there were conversations during the ensuing weeks leading up to the termination, during which advice was amplified and relayed, and then there were the series of phone calls that you alluded to a moment ago.
Yeah, well, I wasn't trying to disparage your position with what preceded the initial advice. I was just trying to make sure I understood the record. And if we look at what the Superior Court said, no matter how cursory the advice might have been initially, everybody agrees the other side got to make their case during the extension period. Is that correct?
That is correct.
May I ask one brief question? What is the significance of the, I believe it's uncontested, that Platinum drafted and proposed this provision? So what is the significance of that fact in the legal interpretation of what good faith means?
Well, I think there's two parts to that answer. The first is that to the extent there were any ambiguity as to what the language on its face means, and we submit there is none, the circumstances under which this provision was inserted clarifies that it was meant to be a good faith standard left to Platinum's discretion, because Platinum wanted it in there and insisted in it in there because they were being asked to sign a deal which in their mind had a potentially catastrophic downside without having had a chance to fully vet it. So in essence, they said, we need this provision in there so that we can complete our due diligence on asbestos and then act accordingly depending on what we find. And that was why it was put in there, and that's why it gives Platinum the right to do the due diligence and take whatever action is appropriate. To the extent that your question is picking up on the other side's argument that this is an issue of language that should be construed against the drafter, I think New York law, and as I'm standing here, I'm afraid that I may have taken this footnote out of my brief for space limitations, but cursory research will tell you that New York law holds that in a transaction among sophisticated companies represented by counsel, the sort of old maxim of construe language against the drafter doesn't really apply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, reference has been made to the Dalton case, and I would submit with respect that the Dalton case can't possibly be the case on which this case was decided. It was the case on which the case was decided in favor of Platinum against Roan. It shouldn't have been. If you look at the Dalton case, what you're talking about there is a student taking the SATs, and the Educational Testing Service, ETS, didn't like how much he improved from one test to the next, so they didn't want to count it. And they sued because the student liked the big increase he got with the second score. And the court made two important rulings, each of which, I think, knocks Platinum right out of court in this case. The first ruling they made was that this was, in their words, an issue of academic discretion. Academic discretion. And it was a case on a subject area where courts are, quote, reluctant to interfere with academic discretion. What in the world does that have to do with an objective standard applied to an acquisition of cellular towers? Nothing. Nothing. Secondly, in that case, even though they let them go to this discretionary standard, they actually found that in that case, ETS hadn't taken into account everything the student had told them as to an explanation as to why he did better. So, frankly, instead of Dalton having been the centerpiece of the lower court's decision as to why Roan lost the case, Dalton should actually be the centerpiece, if anything, of why Roan should have won the case, because it illustrates how narrow is the band in which we get away from this objective standard. The Second Circuit in J.D. Cousins just hits that out of the park when it says the general rule is objectivity and only up here in a little corner, perhaps with Dalton and a few other things, paintings, dresses, academic issues, there we'll only review for good faith. Everywhere else, we're reviewing for an objective standard, and that's what the words good faith under New York law will mean. Comment was also made that this was the only transaction, or effectively the only transaction, that Roan had in front of it. It's a very interesting gateway to another important point, and I guess all roads lead to Yale for some reason in this case, but the chairman of Roan's board was Professor Alan Schwartz of Yale Law School. The people at Roan went back to Professor Schwartz and said, here's the language that Platinum wants to put in terms of a potential terminating provision relating to asbestos liability. Professor Schwartz, who is much published in the field of bankruptcy law, said, that's fine because no one could possibly reach the determination at the end of the day that by acquiring some non-asbestos cellular towers, the acquirer is going to inherit asbestos liability. It's not a merger. It's not the acquisition of Roan as a going business. It's not an assumption of Roan's liabilities, as Justice Ridgely, you pointed out. This is just picking up some assets. It's like buying a typewriter from Johns Manville. If John Mansville wants to get rid of some of its old office typewriters, and I want to buy one for my home office, I don't acquire all the asbestos liabilities of Johns Manville because I pick up some old office equipment from them, and the same thing was true here. The analysis was absolutely inadequate in this case. Even the Superior Court understood that fully. The wrong questions were asked. The analysis was not right, and only if you would accept the unacceptable, which is that there can be an advice of counsel defense to a breach of contract, could the fact that they got this legal advice, which was wrong, possibly exonerate them for a breach of contract that put Roan into bankruptcy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you for excellent briefs and a very helpful argument. We'll take the case under advisement.